I didn't hear you. Thank you, everyone, for being at this Washington Women Technology Network luncheon. And we're really thrilled to be here on this very special occasion. Connie Milstein, who is our friend and host tonight, Karen Appleton from Box, Hillary Rosen, thank you so much. And thank you all for attending. And mostly thank you to Senator Amy Klobuchar, who is one of our favorite senators. We can say that. Look at the big smile on her face. That's great. Actually, that's going to be one of my questions. You're one of the smiling senators. You look happy. Everyone complains.
It sounds like a bad singing group.
Yes, exactly. But you've written this great book, The Senator Next Door. And we're so happy to be that you could be with us today. Betsy Fisher's here with me. And I want to ask the first question, because when I read this book, all I could think of is, this is very Sheryl Sandberg-like. This is very, so I've decided you're the Sheryl Sandberg of the Senate. And the reason is because you're telling women really to lead from the front and know your strengths and get out there. Is that fair and accurate?
Is that good reporting? I think a lot of the books that have been written over the last few decades understandably focus a lot on, especially of women running for office, on sexist comments and harassment. And this stuff is still going on. Don't get me wrong. We just heard Donald Trump's a week ago basically imply that Carly Fiorina couldn't be president because he didn't like her face. So this stuff is still going on. But my point in the book is, one, there have been some improvements. Certainly in the U.S. Senate, there have been improvements. But that, secondly, to get more women in these positions of power and actually governing and in charge of things, the focus should be much more on what we've done, on the impact that women in office can have, on the positive. And we have so many positives. And this is actually only a small part of the book, but I talk about the women senators, how we've worked across the aisle, how Susan Collins stands and gives a speech, and I was the first Democrat to call her, and we formed that group that came up with the idea to end the shutdown, or Debbie Stabenow leading the farm bill, or the work that Barbara Mikulski and Patty Murray did. And you can just go through the women senators, and there was actually a study in Harvard showing that it was true, so it must be true, right, that looked at the number. So that is part of the argument here, is that there is still, it is still an unfair world. I mean, we only have 20 women in the Senate. And as I know, you never know why you're left out of something or why you don't get to be in the gang, literally a gang, and why it's all men. You know, is it because there was a good reason for that and they picked the people that should be in there, or is it because they were more comfortable being together and they didn't want a woman in there? And so you have to think those things and you just push forward. But I think we're at a different level now, and that level means gaining real power. By pointing to the good that we've done and the good we will do in those offices.
Now, Senator, I've read a lot of political books, and I will tell you that your book is one of the most fun books a politician has written. I mean, she goes through and she has, you know, all about growing up, her parents, her first jobs, being a woman, her daughter.
My prom.
Yeah, your prom. And so I want to start with a couple of fun questions, and then we'll get a little bit more serious. Most interviews start serious and then get fun. We're going to start fun. So I just have a couple of quickies that I want you to fill in the blanks on. You got kicked out of elementary school for doing what?
For wearing pants in fourth grade. Mrs. Quady, the principal, kicked me out. And my worst moment since the book came out was I got a call one day, and this guy says, I'm Ron Quady, and my mom's dead, and you made fun of her in the book.
Thanks,
oh, my God.
For that.
You made fun of her hair, that she had this beehive. And I said, well, she did, Ron, and I had a lot of respect for her. But it was a public school, and I had to go wear a dress. And all of a sudden, I hear this laughter, and the voice says, this is Al. It was Franken.
No.
Okay. All right. I totally fell for it. But in any case, that is a true story. Yes,
that's
right.
Great. Okay.
And I talked about how, by the way, back then I did not know how to stand up for myself in fourth grade, and I just cried, and I walked back to my house, put on a dress, and walked up through the woods and came back to school. So.
And you once got dumped on Halloween while you were dressed as a...
Christmas tree. Yes, I was mad. It was actually a longtime boyfriend, and he decided he wanted to get married, but I wasn't the right person. And he picked the moment to tell me this when we were going to a party. And I wore an entire brown tights for the, you know, and a green Christmas tree with ornaments and the thing at the top of my head. And I had plugged myself into the wall with an extension cord with the lights. And it was a pretty low moment. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And speaking of that, you set an all-time Senate record for raising $17,000 from a collection of...
ex-boyfriends, yeah. That was, I mean, the story there was no one would return my calls nationally. I talked a lot about what that was like to raise money when you've never had done it before in any significant way. And that's when I one day just stopped calling people nationally and used all my old, if you remember, Rolodexes and address books. And I did raise $17,000 from ex-boyfriends. And as my husband points out, it's not an expanding base.
Well, and speaking of raising money, I mean, you do, like you said, wrote in the book about that was difficult for you. Do you find, you know, as a woman that it's particularly difficult for women to raise money? And is that something that keeps them out of running for office? And
I think that that has been true for a while. I think it's improving more and more. Part of why it's improving is because we have more women in power in business. That's slow, but it's happening. Women are tending to now start making more money, and women donors tend to give to women candidates. I think the other thing that's changed is men have started to take women more seriously because of the issues that I raised earlier, where you actually see people in positions of power, whether they're on the cabinet level like Penny Pritzker, or, you know, Condoleezza Rice, or whether it is at the elected level. And so I think that makes a difference. They take you more seriously. And instead of, I tell the story in there about how sad it is when you're calling a major donor and you see that they've given thousands of dollars to men, like right down the line, because you see their giving history. You ask for money and they give you $250. Yeah. And so that kind of thing happens still. But again, the answer is to actually call them on. You're like, well, that's so weird. You gave the congressman in my state $1,000, so you got to kind of do it.
How do you find that confidence though, to speak up like that and say something?
Well, I think that is over time. I think mentors have been important to me. I point, you know, out in the book, we had some women that ran before me that were great mentors. They both lost Joan Groh, our Secretary of State. And Ann Winia, who was our Senate Majority Leader, and they both ran a lot on, oh, we need a woman out of our state in the Senate, and it didn't work very well. So I ran in a different way on my record as a prosecutor and on what I wanted to do. So
and
they
you sort
were
of
great.
Downplayed the
downplayed
your gender.
Gender, yeah. I did, yes. And they were mentors, and then since I've gotten to the Senate, of course, the women senators have been amazing, but you find mentors in funny places. John McCain actually brought me on a trip with Lindsey Graham to Asia right after he'd lost the presidential race. And it was just the three of us. And among other things, we stood in front of that cell that he had been kept in for over 5 years in Vietnam, the cell where he had made the decision to allow others to be released before him because he didn't think it was fair that he be released early because his dad was famous and in the Navy. But on that trip, we met with all men because they were leaders in Japan and China and Hong Kong and Vietnam. And every single time McCain would start the discussion, as he was supposed to, he was the leader, and then all the men would look at Lindsey next. And every time McCain would go, you're not going to talk to Senator Graham next. Senator Klobuchar is the Democratic leader on this trip. So things like that, you find mentors in very interesting places. And that's one of the points I make for women going into any occupation.
And you also write about your goals of being a compromiser, trying to reach across the aisle. You mentioned learning a lot of that from Ted Kennedy. Can you talk, and you also write about sort of this toxicity in Washington. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I've tried to get around that in many ways. One, the women senators group's incredible. There's a lot of trust there. The prayer breakfast, I actually led the national prayer breakfast with Johnny Isaacson. And I've gotten to know a lot of people through that group, was why Sessions and Inhofe worked with me on an adoption bill that was incredibly important. We brought tens of thousands of kids in from other countries retroactively. And I got to know people in those ways and build trust. I actually have a section in the book called Republicans I Have Loved to Work With. to make the point that we need to find this middle ground. I call the book the anti-Trump book just because I think this civility is really important to people getting things done. And I also make the case for people that are so sickened by politics right now that there actually are some really good people that work together well and get things done. And I know that's not the common wisdom, but we have to start making the case because it is true. And people don't all just stand in the opposite corners of the boxing ring.
And you also are known for reaching out to journalists and having, you know, being very accessible. Your dad was a journalist. Does that impact how you deal with the media and the press?
I think so. When you grow up the kid of a journalist, you have to have some faith in them, I guess, that they're real people too, and that they're actually really interesting to talk to. And so I grew up, my dad didn't, he was kind of a funny way, he was so talented and had his own column, but he started out with the Associated Press. So it's not like he would have hordes of journalism people over to our house or anything. We'd more likely have like the Vikings football coach come over and they'd get in a big argument. But he, the story that is actually my favorite one in the whole book is right at the beginning of the second section. It's him as a young reporter who is walks into the AP that day and is told that he gets to report on the presidential race at night with two other reporters. And the whole country, it was so tight, no one knew who was winning, Kennedy or Nixon. And my dad was from the Iron Range in Minnesota. My grandpa was an iron ore miner, worked 1,500 feet underground. And Illinois, California, and Minnesota were all out. And the next morning, the three reporters are looking at this, and northern Minnesota will not come in the results, but the rest of the state is tied. So they make the call based on my dad's recommendation. They call him the bureau chief in New York, and the guy, my dad's boss, whose name was Moses, says, well, we're electing Kennedy. And the guy in New York says, I have two words for you guys in Minnesota, be right. And they ended up being right. The New York James Rustin reported the next day as they called the race in Minnesota. 13 minutes later, Nixon conceded. And my dad's story is that he then goes back to work after celebrating at lunch and is given his next assignment, and that is that three pigs are stuck in a mud pit in Faribault, Minnesota. So it's kind of that reporter's life of going from the most glamorous things to the things not so glamorous.
And did that spark your early interest in politics? And I know you did an internship in Washington for Vice President Mondale.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, obviously my dad covered the 68 convention. He covered a lot of politics. He covered anything he wanted. He had a general column, and in addition to that, did sports. For me, the internship with Mondale was probably the first time. It was my first government job ever and my first time in Washington. And I walked into that office all excited. I was a sophomore at Yale, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to write all these policy things. I'd submitted a writing sample, and my first assignment was to do the furniture inventory of every single piece of furniture of the vice president's staff. It took 3 weeks. I had to crawl under lamps and sofas, and I met some people that way, Mike Berman. So I wrote down all the numbers, and as I noted then, I learned two things. One, the vice president was and is an incredibly honest man. Nothing was missing. And second, that was my first government job in Washington, and this was my second. So I always tell people to take their internships very seriously.
So. I want to go back to your dad, because when you were graduating from high school and trying to decide where to go to college, as you write about, he wanted you to go to local school as opposed to Yale. Can you tell that story and how it all happened?
Well, we had, yes, back then, if you think about kids applying now, I didn't even understand how the SAT worked. And it was at a big public high school. And in fact, my friend and I went, we were the only kids taking it, and we got lost going to the other school and missed the SAT. So that left us with only one time left to do that. And I had taken one AP, and I could do one more AP. So the story was that I did really well in the SAT, but after I took it, I realized that you could read a book and find out the kind of questions that would be on it. And I did that with the AP, and my score went up like 30 points or something. And so in all of my college apps, I wrote a note that I found when I looked back at the Yale records, and it said, "Dear Sir/Madam, as you can see, I've done well in my test scores, but they went up 30 points. And if I had known there was a book you could read, I actually found this note. Thank you for your consideration." So I wrote all these applications in the basement eating popsicles. And then I got in a number of schools because I had good grades and did well. And my dad would only go to one. He wasn't going to go to any until the editor of the paper said, "Are you crazy?" And so a guy named Steve Isaacs, who was actually, I think, at the Post for a while. I just ran into him in an elevator. And that's probably how I ended up there, because he told my dad he was crazy. So we ended up going out there and seeing it, and I ended up going there, and it was a huge adjustment on its own. I was alone. I somehow got dropped out.
Did you know anyone at Yale?
No. I had never been on the East Coast except to visit that school once, and I had my suitcases and a trunk, and I walked a mile with two suitcases and go back and get the thing. And I get to our room, and everyone was from the East Coast. And my favorite memory from those first that first month was that one of the girls, I came into the room, and she was sobbing. And I'm like, what's wrong? And she had this beautiful dress on. It's the New York debutante ball, and I'm not flat enough on top. I'm like, no, no, it looks beautiful. Her answer, how would you know, Amy? You've never been to a debutante ball. And I go, no, no, actually, they don't have them in Minnesota. Right. And her answer was, yes, they do. You just weren't invited. And so actually, I then checked later in my life with like the Kohl's and the Wintons and the Pillsbury's. And in fact, they did have them a long time before, but not in the 70s. And so as I noted in the book that one thing we do know for sure, if they did have them, I wouldn't have been invited. So.
But was it strange to be there? I mean, you had a lot of people who were incredibly successful and wealthy and and not from the Midwest.
I mean, first of all, that was a big difference, actually, back then. Now it's so much different. But it's not like I came from poverty. So, and there were some people there that did. So I wouldn't say that, but it was much more, yes, it was different. I had a much more different mindset. I was always looking for free experiment. I would do these experiments to get paid like $50 to breathe cotton dust. And I was always like, and I think in a way that kind of scrappiness that kids don't always have anymore when they're like, they don't always work. They're always trying to do these internships and everything. I think that was actually a really good thing. And I met a lot of kids that way because oftentimes I didn't go home for spring break or Thanksgiving. Except on the Greyhound bus, which took 2 days. And so I think I met a lot of kids that way.
And your daughter, Abigail, is a student at Yale.
She is.
And when you came to Washington, she was middle school, and you all made the decision that you were going to move here, and she was going to go to school here. And can you talk a little bit about, you know, raising a daughter, you know, as an incredibly busy senator? There's one story you tell in the book about helicopter parents and what your daughter came up with to describe you, I thought was great.
Yeah, that was kind of a low moment. Yeah, she said that I was not, she was at the Arlington Public Schools, and we have our house in Minnesota, and I went back there alone every weekend, and then they would come for the summer. It was kind of like how we used, they used to do things in Washington. It actually worked out because some of the senators are here on weekends, and so I got to know people. I got to go to events when I wanted to, but most of the time I went home alone. And my husband was incredible through the whole thing and worked for his law firm in Minneapolis from our apartment for a long time. But, yeah, she at one point, because she was in the Arlington schools and noted that a lot of the moms were helicopter moms and they were always there and they were there when the swimming party happened, blah, blah, blah. She said, well, I finally figured out what you are. And I said, what's that? She said, you're a submarine mom. And I said, oh, that sounds so cool. She said, it's not cool, Mom. It means you lurk below the surface and come up unexpectedly. She's very, very funny. But she, but really through it all, I had decided that, and it, politically, I suppose you could argue it's better to have your family back in the home state. But I just thought, given the Senate is there more, as you know, than the House. And a lot of the moms, other moms, have made the same decision in the Senate. Lisa Murkowski, of course, she has such a long commute, and Kay Bailey Hutchinson for a while had her kids, and Kirsten and others, because you just literally, we are voting always Monday and sometimes Thursday afternoon, sometimes Friday. You literally miss your whole kid's life. You don't know their teachers. You don't know the other students. And so we made a decision like a lot of parents make of in a weird circumstance, what's the best way to do this? That's how we do it. But it was hardest on my husband because he would be there all the time. So he's a pretty good guy.
And he was active in the Senate Spouses Club.
Yes. He was the first man to be active in the Senate Spouse Club. Claire always tells a story, McCaskill, about how one time we were driving out and we looked out the window and we saw him with this pink box. And she yells out, what are you doing, John? And he comes over, it's a Senate Spouse Club event. It's Jim Webb's wife's baby shower. Claire and I are like, yes!
He's one of the girls.
And then she yelled out, that's the sexiest thing I've ever seen. that really happened, yeah.
So, to politics in the campaign, can you share your thoughts on the field, the Democratic field? I know you're a supporter of Hillary Clinton, but the rise of Bernie Sanders, you all came to the Senate together.
Right.
Just at the same time. Has he tapped into something, and what's your
Yeah, I think he has. I think it's early. As I like to point out, some of these polls and everything, Jean Shaheen and I were just talking. In New Hampshire, there have always been other people up, and Hillary ended up winning New Hampshire last time. In Iowa, Michelle Bachmann was up at this time in the Republican thing. So I don't think that I would, in the horse race sort of world, I'm just not that captivated by that argument, only because things change. There's not even been a debate yet. And Bernie has always been heartfelt. He's always had a huge following. And I think that he was ahead of his time in many ways when he was talking about income inequality and all these incredibly important issues. So, and he's always had a grassroots following. But I think the issue will be once we get into the debates and people can evaluate the candidates in this way. And she is running, I know there's just a lot going on, but she's running a really strong operation that I can see. I mean, as we like to say, we can see Iowa from our porch. And, you know, she's got quite a campaign there, and it's much stronger than what she did in the past, much stronger in our state. And so I still feel good about her chances. So.
Do you find that the whole issue of the email situation is a vulnerability for her? And how does she overcome that sort of trust question as a politician? How do you...
Well, I think the first thing is that she has turned over 55,000 emails. She's turned over the server. And she's going to have this hearing, and to me that's going to be a critical time where she has the hearing and also that debate,
right.
And it's within a few weeks. And I think that'll be a very critical moment to kind of turn the focus back on these really important issues and the things she's been talking about.
I want to just ask you one more question about the campaign in the larger picture, because so much of this book is about how you work together, how you use humor, mm-hmm. and the heart that you show on these issues and talking to people to get things done. So when you look at Donald Trump and what's happening in the Republican Party, do you think it'll have a lot? I'm not asking the political question,
no,
will
I get
he be
it.
The nominee? But will it have a lasting impact in politics?
Well, I hope that that kind of coarseness doesn't have a lasting impact. And even some of his policy things are some things Democrats agree to, right? Some of the tax issues he's brought up and things like that. So to me, that's not the issue. And some of the things we vehemently disagree with his stand on immigration. But just that coarseness, even the debate last night, where he just went immediately to going after Rand Paul, who was just sitting there at the end of the thing. I don't quite, you know, it's just that kind of attacks that are really where we don't want to be. And so one of the cases I make in the book is that we really have to be governing for the long term. We have gotten through this crisis governing with the financial downturn, with the TARP bill and the stimulus bill and the Dodd-Frank bill, and now we have this opportunity to govern from opportunity, and that means to me getting long-term tax reform done and simplifying things and making sense out of how we compete internationally. It means doing something on climate change, and it means this immigration reform, which is a huge economic issue for our country, and that is where I hope that people don't go that Trump way, and instead listen to some of the things that Lindsay said last night in the pre-debate, and what some of the other candidates, Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush and others, have been talking about on the Republican side, not to mention all our Democratic candidates who are supportive of immigration reform. But to me, it comes down to an economic issue as much as anything. We have 90 of our Fortune 500 companies formed by immigrants, 200 formed by immigrants or kids of immigrants, 30% of our Nobel laureates from the U.S. were born in other countries. And the way we're having this system work right now, we give unlimited visas to wild hockey players in Minnesota. Yay! That means they can come in from Canada, and we have, okay, fine. But then a doctor from the Mayo Clinic can't bring in their spouse, and so they go to practice in France, or a 3M in Minnesota can't bring in an engineer. So I was glad that that case was made in a more pointed way to differentiate with Trump. And so that is my concern from a policy standpoint, that not govern when we've had so much good bipartisan support in the Senate on immigration reform. And then from a tone standpoint, the case I make in the book is for civility. And it's not like I remember the old days. I'm actually using examples from today. You know, Mitch McConnell and Barbara Boxer negotiated that good transportation bill that's 6 years. That just happened this summer. Or Boehner and Pelosi negotiated the doctor's fix with the Medicare issue. This stuff is happening today. And so people have to acknowledge that, and they have to commend that. And I think in the end, there were other voices last night in that debate, and I think that's very important.
Thank you so much, Senator.
Thank you, Senator.
Loved having you.
It was great.
Thank
All
you.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Now you can have some lunch.
Oh, okay.